Welcome to Talking Brains. I'm your host, Dr. Stephanie Sarkis at stephaniesarkis.com. This episode, I'll be talking with psychologist Ari Tuckman, PsyD, MBA, about sex and ADHD, including discussing his new book, ADHD After Dark, Better Sex Life, Better Relationship. You may remember Dr. Tuckman appeared on Talking Brains last season on the episode, Let's Talk About Sex and ADHD. On that episode, he shared his findings from a survey of more than 3,000 couples that were affected by ADHD. Check that episode out. Dr. Tuckman's in private practice in Westchester, Pennsylvania, where he provides psychotherapy. He's the author of 3 books and 1 workbook, all on ADHD. He's the co-chair of the CHAD Conference Committee. CHAD's the big national ADHD advocacy organization. And if you're in Philadelphia and you attend the conference in November, stop by and see us, because Dr. Tuckman and I are both presenting. He's also a former member of the CHAD Board of Directors. He's also a past vice president and board member of the Attention Deficit Disorder Association. He can be found at tuckmanpsych.com. That's TUCKMANPSYCH.com. Please click that subscribe button and give Talking Brains a 5-star rating. It's appreciated. Enjoy the podcast. Okay, so I'm here with Dr. Ari Tuckman, and Ari was previously on the podcast talking about his survey of couples with ADHD. One person had ADHD and one did not. And he turned that into a 3,000 respondent book now. So there's enough information in there and enough data brought in for everyone that he was able to write a whole book about ADHD and sex called ADHD After Dark, Better Sex Life, Better Relationship. And that's the only book I know of that's on the market right now on ADHD and sex. Is that true? I mean, I didn't see anything else like this available.
No, this is really it. I mean, you know, there's like 4 or 5 really good books on ADHD and relationships. And, you know, there are sort of like passing chapters on how to have a good sex life, where it's important to have a good sex life. But in terms of really getting into the details of what that means and what it looks like and what you need to do, there's really nothing out there. So this really is the first big kind of deep dive into this important part of intimate relationships.
And in the book, you talk a little bit about why this has been something that ADHD After Dark isn't just sex. It's also the part of that we really haven't been talking about this aspect of ADHD. Now, why do you think that is?
Well, because nobody writes or researches sex. Okay. I mean, that's sort of the short answer, that, you know, sex research in general is woefully sort of underfunded. So when you get research about sex, you want it with research about things like STD transmission, unplanned pregnancies, kind of things like that, which are really more like consequences of sex, not the sex itself. And, you know, but I don't know, there's sort of the backstory on this whole thing is I've been working with ADHD for like 20 years now and writing books and presenting and all of that. And you know, there's all the practical aspects of managing ADHD in terms of time management and remembering to do stuff and being organized and whatever. But, you know, ultimately for most of us, our life happiness is not about, do I get places on time? Our life happiness is about, what are the quality of my relationships? So that means intimate romantic relationships, family relationships, friend relationships, coworker relationships. And that's a big part of what ADHD ultimately impacts. And I really wanted, I became more and more interested in this ultimate aspect, which is how do I help my clients with ADHD or my audience with ADHD live a more fulfilling life that includes this specific aspect? And, you know, so that's kind of why I started going more and more into relationships and then more and more into sexuality, because sexuality is such an important part of intimate relationships.
And you mentioned in the book that sex isn't necessarily the glue that holds a relationship together, but it's one of several glues that holds a relationship together.
It is. And that, you know, if you look at people's overall relationship satisfaction and you look at their sexual satisfaction, they tend to overlap about 2/3, kind of give or take. So in other words, it's hard to be happy in one if you are unhappy in the other. So, you know, that was kind of the other part of it, is this idea that couples who already struggle too much by day, so to speak, do not need to then struggle by night. But even more importantly than that is, by neglecting this part of intimate relationships, we're neglecting a really powerful point of intervention, that if we can help these couples do better sexually, feel more connected, feel more grounded with each other, they're going to do better in managing ADHD and all the other kind of mundane nonsense of life. And that's really important, and that to keep your relationship or to keep your sex life good involves doing some important work on yourself, doing some important work with your partner together, for both of you to kind of bring more of your better behavior rather than kind of your lazy or your worst or your kind of minimalistic.
Now, tell me how much treatment impacts ADHD. So we're talking about what's the best way to help people. And I know you mentioned in the survey that meds didn't really make a difference in sexual satisfaction, but tell me how much the treatment of ADHD helps the overall relationship, which in turn can help sex life, I'm assuming.
Right. So, yeah. So I think it's an interesting question, because one of the surprises that came out of this survey was that, you know, kind of a common recommendation that I and others would make is that if you have ADHD and you find yourself to be like distracted or impulsive or trouble with delay of gratification during sex, then, you know, a little bit of stimulant medication while you're having sex is probably going to be a good thing. And it's an easy, obvious suggestion to make. And I totally, like, I would have bet some serious money on that as a good recommendation. But when I asked the question, to what extent do you find that stimulant medication, you know, impacts the quality of a sexual experience, or, you know, something along those lines. I mean, that's sort of the gist of the question. What I found was that it really did not have any consistent benefit. So 47% of the respondents said it had no benefit, positive or negative. And then like a scattering of people, like 3 to 5%, endorsed all of the other answer options. So everything from, you know, mild positive effect or mild negative, moderate positive, strong positive, you know, or moderate negative, strong negative. So it really is like at the level of averages, it's a dead zero. Like, we cannot make this as a recommendation. Now, if you're one of the small percentage of people for whom this is beneficial, then definitely do it. But when it comes to the sexual experience itself, medication is not helpful. However, where treatment in medication in particular is helpful is in getting to the point where you and your partner actually want to have sex with each other. So, in other words, managing ADHD well, generally being a good partner overall, definitely increases the likelihood that you're going to have sex and improves the quality of that sexual experience. So, ADHD medication or ADHD treatment is helpful beforehand, before you get to the sexual experience. And one of the things that I discovered was that when I asked respondents, how much effort do you feel your partner is putting in to managing ADHD, whether it's their ADHD or their partner's ADHD, the folks who felt that their partner put in the most amount of effort were having sex 60% more often than the folks who felt their partner was putting in the least amount of effort. So it was something like, it was 92 times a year versus 53 times a year. So wow. 60% more often. And I think there's kind of a two-level effect there. I think part of it is the obvious level, that if both people are putting in good effort on managing ADHD, then obviously ADHD will have less of a negative effect on their relationship and sex life. But I think there's also an aspect of sort of fairness and, you know, versus kind of resentment, that, you know, do both people feel like the other person is putting in good effort? Are we in this as a team? Are we both doing our part? Versus, do I feel like I'm working a lot harder than you are? And because you're not working hard enough, that's why things are not good. So now I doubly resent you for it.
And then that gets into the three argument topics you're talking about: money, child raising, sex. So it sounds like if one person feels, like you said, that the other person's not kind of pulling their weight in the relationship, then those other things kind of fall apart.
Right, right. And that those, you know, money, kids, and sex are your three big, big argument topics. And partially it's because those are things that are really important. But it's also, those are things that it's harder to kind of each do your own thing. So like, if there's some movie I really want to see and my wife thinks it sounds terrible, like that's fine, because I can watch it sometime without her, you know, problem solved. But, you know, we can't decide, well, I'm going to parent our son this way and you're going to parent our son that way. You know, like that doesn't really work. And if you spend a dollar on one thing, it's not available to spend on something else. So like that won't work. And, you know, if it comes to sex, at least if we're talking about having sex with each other, you know, again, we need to actually come to an agreement. So I think that's what makes those three topics the most charged, is both that they're the most important, but also that you can't just like split the difference or each do your own thing. Like it doesn't really work on those topics.
And I'm thinking too, with the arguments too, with treatment, you're more likely to be able to have a discussion and follow through with the discussion, interrupt less. And so though it's, then it's more a productive discussion, and then it'll lead to actually you having more sex. Is that kind of a, okay.
Absolutely. Plus in general, you're not fighting a million battles a day, you know, that you can have a conversation about like one or two topics without it feeling like, ugh, here we go again, you know. And the sort of like cliche dynamic here is that the non-ADHD partner feels frustrated and resentful that, you know, why does so much of this fall to me? And then the partner with ADHD feels, you know, forever kind of nagged and criticized and like it's never good enough. And that's like a terrible dynamic for both people. You know, nobody's winning at that point.
Right. And let's say that people are pretty satisfied with their sex life, but let's say they have different sexual interests, because that happens in every couple.
Sure.
If you could talk a little bit about the four categories of sexual interests you mentioned in the book.
Sure. So, you know, with sex, as with anything else, including, you know, how much you like going to eat Mexican, for example, there's this sort of, I think it's helpful to sort of think about kind of breaking sexual interest down into four categories. So the first category is something that, you know, yes, I am indeed interested in. So if my wife were to propose something and it's a thing that I know that I like, great, easy, you know, easy bullseye, success. No negotiation needed on that one. Then there are the things that perhaps I'm personally not that into, but I'm willing to do it for her. You know, she enjoys it. This is a good thing. And if nothing else, I kind of get off on her getting off. And the kind of example I always give for this is the non-sexual example is my wife likes having, you know, a glass of tea at night. I don't, like, I'm not morally opposed to tea at night, but like, I don't get anything out of it. I don't want to drink a bunch of tea and then wake up in the middle of the night and have to pee. So like, it's a total zero as far as I'm concerned. But having said that, I will gladly put on some water and pour her some, you know, make her a cup of tea. Like I'm willing to, I'm not saying this is some like great accomplishment, but like, I'm willing to do that for her, you know? So kind of in the same way, there are sexual things that perhaps we each do for the other because the other one is more into it. Then there are the activities or the things that, you know, somebody might be into that's sort of like, I don't really know if I'm into that. I'm not really sure how I feel about it, but I might be willing to try it. You know, like you could potentially kind of talk me into it. And this is important because couples who keep having the same sex often wind up getting bored of it. Now, that's not always true, but, you know, I don't know. There is something to be said for a bit of kind of variety and novelty, especially if we're talking about a relationship that spans the decades. So this willingness to try new things is an important skill to have. Now, the fact that you try something doesn't mean you have to finish it. And the fact that you did it once does not obligate you to do it again. But it's that sort of willingness to give it a shot. And I think that that's really important when it comes to sex, but also other things, you know, like trying a new restaurant or trying, you know, watching a TV show you're not so sure about, but everybody keeps raving about it. So that's kind of the third category, is what are you willing to try? But then equally important is the fourth, which is, this is something I'm not interested in, at least at this time. Meaning I've thought about it, I've tried it, or not. I've just kind of discussed it, and I've asked you, you know, what is it about it that you're interested in? Why is this appealing to you? And I've explained to you why I'm not into it, and that we can be okay with that. Now, you know, we're kind of talking before we hit record here that, you know, kind of the idea of never say never, and I do think that that's important. But I think it's also important on the flip side to kind of know your boundaries and to be able to hold the line when you feel that you need to, because feeling pushed to do things you don't want to do is also going to be kind of a desire killer. That just like boredom and doing the same thing all the time is probably going to lower desire. Also feeling uncomfortable or feeling like you're going to be pressured or feeling like your partner won't be good about taking no for an answer, that's also going to kill desire. So really the sweet spot here is to be able to be honest, to push for what you want respectfully, but to be able to tolerate your partner saying no, but also to be willing to be generous and at least hear your partner out when they push for what they want. And for our couples with ADHD, if they have too many other things that they're wrangling with each other about, they never get around to having these discussions. You know, it's hard to have that kind of honest, vulnerable discussion when you're so frustrated with each other about, you know, 20 other things that happened that day.
So basically, if you unload the dishwasher without being asked, you're going to have a better sex life and you're going to be able to communicate more about it.
Yeah. And I kind of use that line that loading the dishwasher is an aphrodisiac.
Right. That may have been where I got that from. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and let's talk about porn too, because I have quite a few people ask me about porn addiction and what constitutes porn addiction. And I'll have one part of the couple or the other will talk about how they use porn just for release or when the person's out of town. And then the other person says, well, no, this is going to be way overboard. Can you explain a little bit about what porn addiction is or isn't? Because in the book, you said that porn's not addictive in the same way that alcohol is. Right. And that's actually what I had assumed, is that porn addiction was the same as a substance addiction. But if you could explain a little more about that.
So there are therapists out there and treatment programs out there who will say that, you know, that porn addiction is a real thing, or more broadly, sex addiction is a real thing. And then they'll cite these brain scan studies and other stuff like that. But, you know, when you get down to it, all that research and quotes, it's really rather, it's at best either junk science or it's sort of misreading what the research actually says. And that when you look at people who self-identify as porn addicts, what you find is that they're not actually using porn more often than people who don't identify as porn addicts. But, you know, that really what you're picking up on is the fact that people who identify as porn addicts are people who don't feel comfortable with their sexuality or with the porn they're looking at or how often they're looking at it. Or alternatively, their partner doesn't feel comfortable about it. So if you're looking at porn, it means you're a porn addict. Now, the reason why I think this is important is not just sort of the academic question of like, is porn addictive, but that to call something a porn addict, it first of all is incredibly judgmental. And ultimately, a lot of these programs are really rather shaming about rather normal aspects of human sexuality. But it also doesn't really get to the root of what we actually care about. So like, if somebody is looking at porn too much, and, you know, we can have a separate conversation about what is too much. But if they're looking at porn too much, I think we need to ask them why. You know, what is it about porn that is so interesting to you? And often it's one of those things where it's easier to go look at porn and to masturbate on your own than it is to wrangle through the difficult conversations of why are you and me not having more sex together? And, you know, that there are times when looking at porn is just the path of least resistance. It's easier to masturbate on your own than it is to try to approach your partner, either because there's performance problems. So like, you know, a guy has erectile issues, or they're, if it's a heterosexual couple, their female partner, you know, is not interested in sex because they're too frustrated with each other. Or maybe, you know, sex is painful for her and that's like a whole different discussion. You know, but there are reasons why they're avoiding that discussion. So when I looked at my data in the survey, what I found was that there was not actually a clear relationship between relationship satisfaction or sexual satisfaction and porn frequency. That, you know, some people who were really unhappy in their sex life were using a lot more porn, and you could easily see why that might be, as well as perhaps if they're using porn rather than dealing with their problems in their sex life, then maybe you can see why it didn't get better. And yet there are also lots of people who were very happy with their sex life, very happy with their partner, who were also looking at quite a bit of porn. So, you know, I think it's not accurate to say that porn destroys sex lives and relationships, because the data does not back it up. It's just not that simple.
And when we talk about addiction to it, it sounds like, again, like that's more of a value judgment when it comes to porn rather than an actual clinical diagnosis.
Correct. Okay. And it does not exist as an official diagnosis. So the, you know, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM, did not accept porn addiction or sex addiction as valid diagnoses in the last editions or in any of the editions of the DSM, because the science wasn't there. They couldn't prove it to be a real thing.
And I don't even think it's in the source of further discussion where they're asking for more research, right? I don't even think it made it into that section, which is kind of the ramp up to actually being included in the next DSM.
Right. Yeah. I don't remember specifically on that, but I think that that's probably true.
So there's absolutely nothing. You know,
yeah. And the problem is, the problem with a lot of this porn addiction stuff is that it's often used basically as a label for, I don't feel comfortable with what turns you on, you know, meaning from the romantic partner, possibly from the porn addiction counselor, or I don't feel comfortable with what turns me on if it's, you know, if I'm self-identifying as a porn addict. And that it's really more about, you know, coming to some acceptance and understanding that this is something that's appealing to me. Now, just because it's appealing doesn't mean that you act on it. You know, like chocolate chip cookies are very appealing to me, but I rarely act upon that because I don't, you know, want to be eating a bunch of junk. So the fact that somebody is turned on by certain kinds of things does not mean that they should then be acting on it. It doesn't mean they should be, I don't know, looking at porn at work or doing it in a really kind of disrespectful way to their partner. But it's a matter of having some conversation about it, really productive conversation without ultimatums, without judgment, without shame, which then, by the way, tends to provoke a lot of lying and covering up, but like a really honest discussion about, you know, is porn an acceptable part of our relationship and sex life? If so, what kinds? Are there perhaps some that are not acceptable? So for example, you know, video shot of people against, you know, who are not aware that they're being filmed, or like, I don't know, leaked celebrity videos. Like, is that acceptable? Like, can you feel okay about supporting that kind of a thing? You know, so there are discussions to be had on that. But then there's also discussions to be had separate from porn on masturbation just more generally. So where does masturbation fit? And there are definitely people who feel that their partner masturbating is akin to cheating because some of their sexual energy is going somewhere other than to their partner. And, you know, my sort of initial response to that always is, you know, be careful what you wish for, because if your partner can't masturbate and all of their sexual outlet has to come from you, you may not always want it. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think to say, if I'm not interested, you can't do anything at all. I mean, you can say that, but I think that's sometimes a tough sales pitch, especially when there's a big desire discrepancy between the two of you.
So when you say a sexual problem in one partner may indicate a complementary problem in another partner. So for instance, well, I watch porn a lot, but you know, you don't want me to masturbate when you're here. And then that means that, well, maybe the real issue is that they aren't on the same page. Well, the complementary problem would be that person may not be open to talking about it, or that's been kind of a taboo topic. And so then it becomes this maelstrom of how are we going to communicate about this, which leads to more porn use. Was that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. You know, it can be this thing that, you know, porn can be the path of least resistance for both partners, meaning, you know, the one who's looking at porn rather than having tough conversations with their partner, but also their partner who at some level has to know. And they are also not having conversations, or they're just blaming it on porn. You know, if it wasn't for porn, and, you know, then our sex life would be great, you know, which is like half true. But the other half is, even if you magically disappeared porn from the world, you would still have your other issues that are getting in the way of you guys having sex. Because for most people, partner sexual activities are more satisfying and interesting than solo sexual experiences, generally speaking, in that, you know, if their partner was available and if they knew that they would be having a good sexual experience together, they wouldn't choose porn instead. So, you know, so it's kind of like ain't nothing for free kind of thing. Like, if you want your partner to look at no porn or a lot less porn, you need to be able to have those honest conversations. And if you don't want to feel like you have to sneak porn or hide it and feel guilty about doing that, then again, you need to have those honest conversations about it.
So, like you said, that watching porn is kind of an outlet and also kind of the path of least resistance. It sounds like also porn becomes a scapegoat for what the other person doesn't want to bring up.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, let's blame the porn rather than the fact that, you know, I'm never interested in having sex with you.
Right.
You know?
Right. And you mentioned those issues would be being tired, overworked, just general lack of communication. A lot of people have not talked about sex and during their lifetimes. It's just not something that people generally feel comfortable with in our society. So, and you have a great list of questions to ask one another or to talk about with a therapist. And that leads to my other question, which is, first, if you could explain what a sex therapist is and then what services they provide, and when do you know that you need to go to one?
Sure. So, you know, a sex therapist is, first of all, a therapist. So they are trained and licensed as a therapist already. So they are a psychologist, a counselor, a social worker, whatever, who then has some additional training to specialize in sexual matters. Because, you know, there really is, just like, you know, for ADHD, if you're going to work with folks with ADHD, it's important that you have good general clinical skills, but then also specific knowledge about ADHD. Same thing for sex therapy, that there are certain very specific things that you need a sex therapist to know about. And then, you know, what you do is you go in, you talk in the office about all the different things that go in and, you know, into whatever the problem is. And then, you know, you go home and you try things on your own or with your partner or something. So the primary credentialing agency for sex therapists is known as ASECT. So AASECT, American Association of Sexuality Educators, Counselors, and Therapists.
Oh, are you there? Hey, so it said it dropped out because of a bad connection.
Duh, shit.
Yeah, so I got the ASECT part. So if you you're saying that, so ASECT is the, and then right when you're saying what it was, it cut off.
Okay.
And shut off your video too, so your audio goes up.
Right. Okay.
There you go. Okay.
So ASECT is the American Association of Sexuality Educators, Counselors, and Therapists. And if you go to ASECT.org, you can then find a provider directory of folks who are hopefully in your geographical area that you can meet with. But, you know, a sex therapist can help not only with kind of very specific sexual concerns, like, let's say, erectile disorder, or a female for whom, you know, penetrative sex is uncomfortable or painful, but can also help with other things. So, like, I'll just sort of invent a scenario here. So, you know, kind of like a couple who comes in, let's just say the guy has ADHD, the woman doesn't, And the woman catches the guy looking at porn and then goes through his browser history and sees how much porn he's looking at. And, you know, in general, men tend to look at more porn than women, although women are looking at more porn than they used to. Those with ADHD are more likely to be looking at porn than those without. Guy with ADHD will tend to have a higher desire, a significantly higher desired sexual frequency than his non-ADHD female partner. So there's this big difference there, and he's using porn and masturbation as a way to fill in the gaps of what of the sex that he's not having with her. And rather than just labeling it a porn addiction, which just keeps the focus on, okay, buddy, stop looking at porn, you know, a good sex therapist is going to be able to go beyond that. So what, you know, for the female partner, what exactly is it about the porn that you're comfortable with? Why is that? For the guy, you know, what happens that you choose to look at porn instead of approaching your partner for sex? What conversations have you guys had about this? Probably not enough. And if they were conversations, they probably weren't good ones, weren't productive ones. But might also get into other stuff, that maybe the woman is too tired at the end of the night and too resentful because she doesn't feel like her ADHD partner is doing enough on his end of things, because she's griping at him all night. He's not interested in being vulnerable with her and approaching her for sex. So they don't ever get around to it because there's not enough good feelings and there's not enough good time to actually have that sex together. So, you know, so a good sex therapist who hopefully also understands ADHD would get into these other issues that go beyond just the sex part of it and that go beyond just the porn part of it. So him going to 12-step groups to not look at porn is like the tip of the iceberg that is completely not helpful if you don't address everything else that's behind it.
And it sounds like also a sex therapist can talk to you about the comorbid disorders with ADHD, like depression, anxiety, and it's not just sex.
Absolutely.
Because your background is, go ahead.
Yeah, and that's the part that they're a therapist first, you know, so it's not just that they focus on sex, they focus on all the rest of it. So if a guy is looking at a lot of porn, maybe it's he's self-medicating for anxiety or depression. Maybe that's the thing that we need to focus on. And that if we can get his mood to a better place, maybe all of a sudden the porn kind of takes care of itself.
Well, it sounds like your book's going to help a lot of people. What's a main takeaway that you'd like people to get from your book, ADHD After Dark?
I think my main takeaway is that if ADHD is a part of your relationship, it doesn't need to be the defining part, and that working together on your relationship overall will give you a better sex life, and working on your sex life will give you a better relationship overall. And that I want both sides of that coin to be as good as they can be. And, you know, it's that process of working on them is what will make both of you into better people.
And I found the book also was good, just not for just for people with ADHD, but people for that just have sex in general.
Yeah.
So I think you have a lot of really good points about communication. It's not just sex. I mean, it sounds like if it's going well, it's not a big deal, but if it's not going well, it's a really big deal.
Yeah, absolutely. That is definitely true.
And I encourage everybody to check out the previous podcast you're on, where you talked all about the results of your survey, because it was a huge survey with 3,000 people. And also, I just want to throw in there too, the reason why we're talking about heterosexual couples is that there is a much greater representation of heterosexual couples rather than LGBTQ couples in your survey. So I just wanted to.
Right. Yeah, I did make the survey open to same-sex couples. Unfortunately, I just didn't get enough responses from them to be able to do anything meaningful with the data. So, you know, so like with everything, some of this stuff related to heterosexual couples will also apply to same-sex couples, because some things just really are the same regardless. And then there are definitely aspects that are not the same. And there are things that will be different for same-sex couples.
And that'll be your next book.
Yeah. Exactly. Put it on the list.
Well, thank you very much, Ari. I appreciate it.
So, yeah, no, my pleasure. I think this is really important stuff. I think it's you know, I appreciate your help in kind of getting the word out about this and sort of having this conversation about it. Because, you know, the joke that I had when I was in the process of writing the book was that ADHD and sex is a topic that nobody is talking about. And by nobody, what I mean is the people who write books and stand in front of audiences to do presentations. Every single couple is talking about it a lot, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's this kind of big topic that has been, I think, unaddressed for far too long.
Oh, I completely agree. And thank you so much for writing this book and helping so many people. I think it's going to change a lot of lives.
I hope so. I hope so. I put a ton of work into it because I really, really wanted it to be as good as possible because I think it there is so much on the line for it. Like, I think that the couples who can do well in their sex life will do better in their relationship overall, which will benefit not only the two members of the couple, but it'll also benefit their kids if they have them. Because, you know, we know when parents do better together, the kids do better too. So, you know, this really is bigger than just, you know, having a good time on Saturday night.
Right. I think that's an excellent point that when I tend to see couples and kids, it's usually that the parents are very split up. And when you meet with the parents alone, a lot of it boiled down to issues of who had what role in the relationship, their sex life. And that's what ultimately led to the end of the relationship. And it seems like by reading this book, people could get on the same page about a lot of things, or maybe even decide that we're never going to be on the same page. Maybe we can find a civil way to end things. So it sounds like it's going to help both ways, and kids benefit either way.
Right. I mean, the thing is, it's not divorce that's problematic for kids. It's nasty divorces.
Right.
But you know what? Nasty marriages are also bad for kids. So, you know, I'm not going to say every couple who got married has to stay married forever, but it really is. And I mean, I literally said this an hour ago before we started recording to a client I had that, you know, the goal is to make a really good decision. And that decision is either we're both going to work really hard to stay together because separating is going to be hard in so many ways, or we get to a point where we realize, you know what, we are just not actually good together, and no hard feelings. I mean, easy to say, but you know what, let's end this in a civilized way that we can both feel okay about, and let's go seek our fortunes elsewhere. But that is so much better than all my clients who've been dragged through these nasty, long, contentious divorces. Like, nobody's winning there.
Right. And kids that go through that have a higher rate of divorce. And I was just talking to another podcast guest about how when parents have a civil divorce, they've noticed, I think that the child divorce rate when they get older has dropped by about 25% if you have a civil divorce. So it's a pretty big difference there. So yeah, I think that's an excellent point that this book doesn't just apply to sex, it applies to just well-being of future generations in your family.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Ari. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for having me. I always like hanging out with you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Talking Brains. And a special thank you to Dr. Ari Tuchman for sharing information from his new book, ADHD After Dark, Better Sex Life, Better Relationship. Dr. Tuchman can be found at TuchmanPsych.com. That's TuchmanPsych.com. I'm your host, Dr. Stephanie Sarkis, and I'm at StephanieSarkis.com. Please hit subscribe and give us a 5-star rating. It's appreciated. Thank you and have a great day.